open up the House Committee on Human Services today, February 5th, 2010. Remind everybody to turn off their cell phones, their raspberries, blueberries.
Blackberries.
All those berries. Thank you. And we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3631. Rick, do you want to read us the summary, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair. You did hear this bill a couple days ago. This does prohibit insurers from treating injuries from sexual violence as pre-existing conditions for coverage. We did have -1 amendments that you adopted at the last meeting. However, we didn't have all the fiscal revenue information at the time. Since then, we have received it back. There's no fiscal, no revenue on that. So that the committee would like they could pass this out today.
See, this is in here.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3631 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Van Orman recommends that we pass House Bill 3631 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Frederick?
Absent.
Or excused.
Is he excused?
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Absent.
Representative Doherty?
Is he excused? Aye. Go ahead.
I said aye.
Okay.
Not present.
Still. Thank you.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
And Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received
I didn't get to.
I'm sorry, Debbie. How did we miss you?
Aye.
Sorry, Debbie.
I'm invisible today.
I know you're.
But I wear red.
Yes. Having received the required majority, this House Bill 3631 passes and goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Madam Chair, do you want to authorize a search warrant and we'll go out right now and find those two on the end?
No.
No. We can reopen.
They're adults.
Okay. He's a carrier.
Oh, carrier. Suzanne, would you be the carrier for that bill?
Thank you so much for offering. Yes, I would. I'd love to carry my bill. That's terrific.
Thank you. Okay, we'll open up. All right, I open up a work session on House Bill 3623.
Chair 3623, you did hear last week as well. This does allow not-for-profit organizations to supply the Oregon Liquor Control Commission materials on human trafficking. It does allow the materials to supply to include copies that they go to each license renewal that the commission sends off to on-premise, off-premise, and brewery-type establishments. You did adopt at the last meeting the -2 amendments, which basically stipulate that materials that our commission considers offensive or inappropriate, they could be excluded, and clarifies that any 501c organization could supply these materials. So at that meeting, you did supply the -2s. We didn't have the right fiscal revenue information at the time. We do have it now. There is no fiscal revenue on that. On those -2 amendments.
Great.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3623 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson suggests that we send House Bill 3623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Absent.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Mauer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
And Chair Tomlin?
Aye. Got the call?
She said me first this time.
Good.
Thanks, Deb.
Having received the required majority, House Bill 3623 passes unanimously to the floor. And Debbie, would you be the carrier for this, please?
Sure.
Thank you. All right. Close the work session on House Bill 3623 and, pardon?
You know, maybe.
Bartonsville.
You want to give it to Representative Barton?
Yes, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
We will. So change that to Representative Brent Barton. Thank you. Okay. We will open up a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 3668. Okay. Do you want to read the staff member summary?
Thank you, Chair. Let's see if I find it. House Bill 3668 modifies the date by which licensed professional counselors and marriage and family therapists must attest to having certain training and experience. There are some proponents here of the bill, I believe, or they were scheduled to come in to testify on this at least. You may want to query the audience to see if someone is here to talk to this bill. Anyways, this is, I understand, kind of a technical fix bill. It does distinguish between a licensed mental health provider and unlicensed provider, prevents unlicensed counselors and therapists from using misleading language, requires that unlicensed counselors and therapists disclose their status, and provides for penalties for failure to comply with the requirements of the bill.
So we, yes.
If there isn't anybody, because I can give you a quick update on.
That would be great. Is there anyone here who would like to testify on this bill? See, not Representative Mauer.
Yeah. Madam Chair, what, there was a few licensed professional counselors and LMFTs that were left, were in a window where they couldn't get the training in order to get their license, and have had their license revoked, some voluntarily. We heard that in committee in the interim, and in fact, this was a technical fix and clearly not the intent of where we were going, so we need to do this.
Absolutely.
Good bill should pass.
Yes, absolutely. Any other questions or discussion? All right, seeing none. Debbie, would you call the, oh, did we have a motion yet?
No, Madam Chair, we're still in a public hearing.
Public hearing, okay.
And we do have the fiscal revenue on this, it's okay.
Okay. All right, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3668 and open up a work session on House Bill 3668.
Motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3668 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves that House Bill 3668 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Dendro?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Slater?
Absent.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Mauer?
Yes.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
And Chair Tomlin?
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 3668 passes. We'll go to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Mauer, would you carry that? Thank you. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3668.
Work session.
Is that okay?
We close the work session.
Oh, work session. Okay. And open up a work session on House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 3669. Thank you. Okay, do you want to read the staff measure summary?
Thank you. Chair, House Bill 3669 repeals requirements for disclosure of protected health information regarding individuals between providers of behavioral and physical health. During the 74th Legislative Assembly, you enacted Senate Bill 163, which allows for exchange of specific health information between managed care organizations without requiring additional individual patient authorization. However, the information could only be shared with patients' consent. From some discussions during the interim, there appeared to be some issues or problems in communicating, so a work group along with some members, I think yourself involved, might have.
Just by phone, right.
By phone. Discussed this issue and came up with this bill. And there are some proponents here, I believe, to talk to this.
Right. Cindy and Martin. Martin Taylor? Is Martin here? Good. I can see you. Thank you for coming today. Thank you for working so hard on this. I know it was an issue that had unintended consequences, and we're happy to go back and fix it. I think we're happy to go back and fix it.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I know we were in front of you very recently in a more in-depth way, so we're mostly here to answer questions. Just by way of background, this is a bill that passed in 2007, intended to make it a little easier for physical health and mental health plans to do case management for individuals. The result of the bill was that it was very difficult to administer, and now that we're beginning to try to figure out how to integrate systems and need to look at larger groups of data, the system is really not practical. So what we're asking you to do is simply repeal the bill from 2007, create a clean slate, and the process of bringing this bill to you included talking to the mental health plans, the physical health plans, the counties, the state, and the advocates. At this point, we're confident that there's an agreement that starting over again would be a better course than trying to make this law work. So that's what we're asking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the director of the Clackamas County Department of Health, Housing, and Human Services. And I'm very happy to be here this morning to talk about this bill. As you know, we have worked really hard. We actually worked hard the first time in 2007. Unfortunately, the intent was never realized. The intent was really to help plans, physical health plans and mental health plans that serve the same individual to be able to share information about that individual so that they could have integrated, improved care for them. And what happened along the way is that the various parts of the bill that were passed, as Martin said, became impossible to implement. And so rather than try to spend a whole lot of money trying to fix something that really would be better off starting over, we come to you with this bill. And last time I testified in front of you, someone said to me, why were you so happy when you testified? And I said, because it's really unusual that you have so much agreement on the bill that when you turn around, you know no one's trying to kill you after your testimony. So this is such a bill. Everyone that we have talked to does agree that this is the right thing to do, so we hope that you'll pass it.
Thank you. Any questions of either of these witnesses? Representative Maurer.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. So on line 5 of the bill, 3669, where it says the word repeal. Is that the intent we're going to throw? Really?
Yes.
And you worked really hard on that?
Yes. A lot of work to get that word in.
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
You're not in trouble, guys. Where are you?
Yes, sure. Representative, would you continue this?
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay. Representative Maurer, that was a great question or a great thought anyways.
Mr. Chair, could you please point out that Representative Maurer is not wearing red today?
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid I'll have to join Representative Maurer.
No, I blew it. I thought it was next Friday.
Oh.
Emotionally.
Wear red
we're
day.
Wearing red.
Women's heart disease. Emotionally. First year I wore red pants. Yeah. That didn't go over so well. So I graduated with a red coat.
Parked cars last year, huh? What? You had your red coat
well,
on?
Yeah, it's a new
one. Oh, you have red on, too. And I was too tired to go shopping.
I know. I just feel really bad.
Don't feel bad.
You don't have red car okay. Parts?
We're gonna stand at ease here for a few minutes.
Debbie.
Debbie, you okay? Okay. I open up the public, we're still public hearing.
Let them go. You can open up.
Okay, I will open up the public hearing on House Bill 3669.
No, I'm sorry.
This one right now?
This is Denver.
I think we're closing the public.
Did you vote on it?
No, we haven't.
No, we left it for you.
We just did recess.
Madam Chair, you were absent.
Wait a minute. A black mark against me.
Give me that gold sticker you've got. I want it.
If this will come in before 10, we can go to work session.
Okay, all right.
We can open up a public hearing.
I didn't realize there was a second one.
I'm sorry. Well, you're still waiting for it.
Yeah, okay.
It's truly a Friday, isn't it?
Yes, okay. Well, actually, you wrote it right there. Okay, now I'm going to open up a public hearing on 3618. Okay, 3618. All right.
The Denver wants to put it on chapter 5. And then here's the list of people who would like to come up.
Okay. Representative Dimbro, do you want to go down and tell us all about this wonderful bill?
And he may want to call up some people as well.
Okay, and Bob Junedef, could you come up also?
They have red dice on them. Yeah.
Because we recessed.
Bob's got red.
So we need to come back on that.
Well, we didn't have a fiscal. Yeah.
Those are already, okay.
Yeah.
No, we got revenue, but we don't have.
Okay, Representative Dimbro.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable colleagues, the Human Services Committee. I bring to you formally House Bill 3618 today. For the record, I am Michael Dimbro, State Representative for House District 45, that is Northeast Portland to Park Rose, and the little city within a city of Maywood Park. We had an extensive hearing on this bill back in January. Hard to believe that was just a couple of weeks ago. At that time, we talked to you conceptually about amendments that we were working on to come before you with. And since then, a coalition of stakeholders has been meeting continuously in large group, actually a group that got larger and larger. And small group, one-on-one, email, telephone, trying to come up with amendments that captured both the spirit and the intentionality of the endeavor that we were working on, but also anticipated problems and sought to find solutions to problems that could come up down the road. And I believe that we have gotten there in the form of the Dash 3 amendments that are before you that we emailed to you late yesterday. We are still waiting for a fiscal on these amendments, and hopefully Paul Revere will come down and bearing them in hand. But if not, that may be a problem. But I certainly will talk to you about the fiscal on the bill. I want to just, first of all, thank the people who really have been working hard with me on this bill. First of all, Bob Junedef from Disability Rights Oregon, Catherine White from the DD Coalition, Megan Moyer, Arthur Towers from SEIU, Cheryl Sanders Miller from the Home Care Commission, James Taves from SPD, Leah Kraft, Mark Mayer, who is the drafter from Legislative Council, has been doing really great supportive work on this. I also want to thank Senator Morissette, the sponsor on the Senate side, for his ongoing perspective and support. Just to remind you quickly, this bill continues a process that began over 10 years ago with a constitutional ballot measure, which passed by nearly a 2-to-1 vote, whose purpose was to create a home care commission, which would allow people who provided care in the home for seniors and persons with disabilities access to training, to a registry of care providers, a path to unionization, and workers' compensation. Again, these programs, you know, as I know you know, provide crucial state support to individuals, seniors, and persons with disabilities, allowing them to stay out of institutions, live at home or in small group settings, remain active in their communities, and in many cases remain active workers, maintain their independence, their autonomy, their dignity, and their self-determination. As you know also, moving people out of institutions, aside from the positive impact on their lives and the lives of their families, has also been a great cost saver for the state. This is a much more affordable, efficient way of dealing with care, getting more bang out of our Medicaid dollars. The downside has been that those working with those formerly institutionalized, once they left the institutional setting, no longer had access to workers' compensation if they were injured while on the job, nor do they have a systematic program of trainings, nor do they have access, if they so choose, to join a union of their choice. That is, unless they're working with seniors or persons with physical disabilities. For various reasons that you've heard about, a distinction was made between those with physical disabilities and those with developmental disabilities or mental illness. And this bill, House Bill 3618, seeks to overcome this unfortunate, unnecessary, and inequitable distinction. It'll ultimately give the 8,000 or so workers doing this work, this very important, but also in many cases very difficult work, all over the state, access to workers' compensation and a training program by January 1st, 2011. They will have representation with the Home Care Commission, and clients, as well as workers, will have representation via the new Developmental Disabilities and Mental Health Committee, which we talked to you about conceptually last time, which will begin advising the Commission immediately on how best to integrate and move forward. The new workers will gradually be added to the Home Care Worker Registry for use by those seeking personal support workers, with final rollout by 2013. If they so choose, they will be able to begin the long process of unionization in 2011. There are certainly many people in this state and even in this room who wish that this bill were unnecessary and we had been bringing both populations into the home care system 10 years ago, that we've been doing it for the last 10 years. That did not happen. But today we have an opportunity to make that happen. I will say that in retrospect, it's possible that things turned out for the best, to the degree that the Home Care Commission has had 10 years to get itself off the ground and to provide really an impressive series of trainings that it's offering now. It is to acquire the infrastructure and hire really a first-rate executive director in Cheryl Sanders Miller. I had the good fortune yesterday of attending one of the monthly meetings of the Home Care Commission, and I have to tell you, I was so impressed to see the range of disabilities and abilities around the table at that commission meeting, and just what an able commission that is. They are ready to take on this task, and I believe that it's the time for us to make that happen. As I mentioned before, we are still waiting on the fiscal for this, and James Taves will come up and we'll be able to answer some questions about the estimates that we're looking at. Roughly, we're looking at a biennial cost for this biennium of between $800,000 and $900,000. Most of that would go to workers' compensation, but also for necessary information tech support, and also for the commission to hire a couple of staff members to begin to integrate the new workers. We're looking at roll-up costs of $2.2 to $2.3 million for the next biennium.
Million?
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
Representative Maurer?
Repeat the number. I missed that.
And again, James may be able to refine this, but what I was told was 2.2 to 2.3.
Okay.
For 2011-2013. This is, of course, something that will be dealt with in Ways and Means, as this bill has a subsequent referral, and we'll continue to work on it there. For today, what I'm really hoping is that we can zero in on the policy side of this, and I would really assert that this is important policy, and it's policy whose time really has come. Let me just lay out for you the sequence of speakers who will follow me. First of all, Bob Joondaff will talk about the Dash 3 amendments and what they are seeking to accomplish. Deborah Brown, let me just back up and say that last time you heard from both workers and client advocates from the developmental disabled community. Today you're going to hear from a worker who works with medically fragile children, which is another population that would be brought in under this bill, and mental health, people with mental health issues. We'll be hearing about that. So Deborah Brown, who works with medically fragile children, will talk to you about the work that she does. Marcy Ingledew, who represents, she's with the Arc of Oregon. She will be here representing the DD Coalition. Morgan Cowling will be here to give a county perspective on this, because the counties have an important role to play in the delivery of these services. James Taves from SPD will be here to talk about the DHS perspective. Richard Harris will again be able to answer any questions you might have about the population of persons with mental illness. So that's what we have in front of you. We also have some written testimony. I don't know if it's come to you yet, from in support of the bill from AARP, from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and the Alliance for Retired Americans. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have for me, or if you want to wait until Bob has explained the amendments, that would be fine too. Thank you.
We wait until Bob explains amendments and we'll have questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Joondaff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. Our organization advocates on behalf of Oregonians with disabilities across the board, and so this bill, which affects such a wide variety of people with disabilities, is one that we were very concerned about. And we're there to really try to work to make it the best bill it can be to accomplish its purpose. Toward that end, I've worked very closely with Representative Dem Brown, thank you, and Mark Meyer from Legislative Council to try to work out a lot of details, really. And what I've now tried to do for you in the written testimony that I provided is a distillation of what we accomplished. I will essentially be reading this testimony because I think it's as compact as I can explain it, because it is a 17-page bill and it has a lot of details in it. And if that's all right with the chair, I would just move ahead and do that. And of course, I can answer any questions.
We do have this in front of us, and we can follow you along.
Okay. If adopted, the amendments contained in House Bill 3618-3 will not change the purpose of the legislation, but will clarify that purpose and correct some technical errors in earlier versions. Page 1, lines 1 through 3, page 1 and lines 1 through 3 on page 2 contain statements of legislative intent. They appear in the bill, but they would not appear in ORS, according to legislative counsel. And these provisions state that home care workers and personal support workers, and we'll get to those definitions in a bit, provide essential services to seniors and people with physical, developmental, and mental disabilities. The state has a duty to provide workers' compensation coverage to these workers, but this legislation is not intended to compromise the resources and choices available to seniors and people with physical, developmental, and mental disabilities. Seniors with physical, developmental, and mental disabilities and their families have a right to choose among available services, activities, and purchases, and this legislation is not intended to reduce the amount or scope of services to those of those currently available to those who receive care from home care workers. So what you see reflected here are statements of your intent should this bill be passed, which essentially say that this bill is trying to accomplish important things that the state has a duty to do, and that it is not the intent of the legislation to somehow diminish other services that people receive. Section 2 of the Dash 3 amendments set out legislative findings and declarations that will appear in the ORS. So this will, when you open the statute book, this language will be there. And they state that the interest and welfare of the public is served by the establishment of the Home Care Commission as set forth in statute and whose operations do not compromise the resources of the service population, and by service population, I'm referring to all those people with disabilities that were mentioned above. It's a mouthful going through them all every time. Do not compromise the ability of service population members to choose among services, activities, and purchases, and do not reduce the amount and scope of services, activities, and purchases available to the service population. And again, this is a statement that is designed to recognize that the legislature has an interest in establishing the commission. This commission, as you know, was established by constitutional amendment, but there is no statement presently saying that the legislature is establishing it, even though there it is in statute. And then again, it reiterates that the legislature is finding that it is important to establish this commission, but not for the purpose of reducing choice, reducing services, and other options. Section 3 directs the Home Care Commission to create a Developmental Disabilities and Mental Health Committee to advise the commission on all functions related to these two new populations that would be brought under the Home Care Commission. The commission is directed to appoint members who shall include at least one consumer and one family member from the developmental disabilities area and the mental health area, one advocate, one personal support worker, one representative of a public agency, and one representative of a support service brokerage. And these are the entities that are tasked with the responsibility of collecting names of workers and passing them on to the department or the commission, depending upon the timing. Section 4 gets into the mechanics of how this will work, and it sets forth a process for collecting information which identifies home care workers who serve the newly covered populations, mental health and developmental disabilities. It directs the Department of Human Services to collect this information with assistance of public agencies, that would most often be counties, and support service brokerages, which are nonprofit organizations that provide brokerage services to the DD population. This section becomes operative on October 1st, 2010, but collecting agencies are authorized to get started earlier if they choose to do so. And Department of Human Services is to maintain the information collected up until July of 2013 when it hands it over to the Home Care Commission. Section 4 contains a number of definitions that are consistent throughout the bill, and the bill can be confusing because it rolls in three time periods of enactment. But all of these definitions remain consistent across that roll-in that roll-in process. And those definitions include activities of community inclusion, adult support services, home care services, home care worker, a person with a disability, personal support worker, and personal and support services brokerage. Now, the reason we have so many definitions is really reflective of the challenge that we had before us in integrating different types of service systems together. The service system that is presently administered by seniors and people with disabilities is different from the services administered for people with developmental disabilities, which is different than the services administered for people with mental illness. And so there's different ways of describing what they are, describing who is doing them, and trying to capture them all into a single arena while not ignoring the fact that they are different for those particular populations. Section 6 and 9 of the bill become operative on January 1 of 2011, and they maintain the definitions and directives set out in earlier sections and add a new responsibility for the Home Care Commission to ensure that services, activities, and purchases other than home care services are not compromised or diminished, and they specify that the Commission may elect workers' compensation coverage on behalf of clients of both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Finally, Section 11 is the section that brings it all together. It becomes operative on July 1st, 2013, and it completes the integration of the new populations into the Commission. And all of the newly collected information that is in the possession of the Department of Human Services will be shifted over to the Home Care Commission, and we will move forward. So that's what these amendments achieve.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Colleagues, this is a very complicated bill, and we're hearing a lot of complicated information today. So I want you to take as much time as you need to understand what is going on and what is being asked of us. So, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, and this is just a real simple question. For the money that we're going to spend, what better service are we buying for the people that's covered under this? I'm just trying to understand kind of a conceptual, we're going to be spending $2 to $3 million more a biennium. How is the service going to be better to those that receive it?
Rep. Freeman, just, you know, in terms of the service aspect, the training component of this is going to be very important. You know, I think we all know the importance of having good training for people working, as you can imagine, working with these populations. And it is, I think going to really improve, the service to the clients. We have a situation now where, it's kind of a double whammy, I think, in many cases, where you have workers who are not getting the level of training that they need. Plus, they don't have access to workers' compensation. The lack of training can cause injury to themselves, which they can't treat because, you know, in many cases, you know, these are not highly paid workers, and they can't afford to get the immediate treatment that they need, which exacerbates the, you know, the problem, which exacerbates the problem for the client, you know, because they're not, you know, they're not as fit as they should be to deal with the client. And so from my understanding with, you know, all the populations that have been working with the Home Care Commission is that the combination of training and workers' compensation has made a substantial difference for you know, the level of care that they've been able to offer, as well as it has really stabilized the workforce, you know, avoided a lot of the turnover that otherwise would have been there.
Just a quick follow-up. So in kind of in round numbers, percentage-wise, how much of the increased cost is training and how much is the workman's comp insurance? Do you have any idea? Is it 50-50 or is it mostly training, or how does it break down?
I would say that it's mainly the workers' comp.
That's where most of the money's being spent then, on the workman's comp side?
As you can imagine, you know, the insurance is, you know, to cover them, and it, you know, rating is done, and the new workers are being rated. SAFE has you know, looked into it and is rating the new workers at the same level as the existing workers, for whom there's a lot of experience now. You know, in terms of utilization. So, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to go back and revisit the Dash 3 amendments. And Representative Dembro, you and I had a chance to kind of talk about that at length yesterday, and I really greatly appreciate you giving me those heads up. The first, there's actually three areas that I have of the Dash 3s. I have and the first one I have is, to be truthful with you, some serious concern with, and it's on page 7, it's section 6, but if you look at the bill originally, it is initially on page 2 of the bill, it reflects basically the same thing, section 17B is what I'm interested in the bill, and that's what the Dash 3s address. Now, I have a Dash 2 amendment that actually removes that portion there of lines 23 and 24 of the bill, but let's go through it because I just want to walk through this a little bit and get both of your input. I'd greatly appreciate this. The bill itself says, the department shall provide the name and address of a home care worker to any, that's huge for me, individual who requests the information. Now, I come here with my background, having been in law enforcement for 29 years. I have a serious concern about protection.
Yeah.
So as we glean the information the DHS is responsible for obtaining to have out there, anybody can get that information. Now, I understand what probably twofold the reasoning behind what was happening with that portion of Section 1 of the bill originally for collecting that information. But if I'm a burglar and have been convicted of burglary one, there's nothing that prevents me from getting this. And that's a serious issue. If I'm a home care worker, I don't want my name out there. And that's why I'm saying that right now from this point of view, that's an ugly piece of the policy for me anyways. And that's why I wanted to try to be proactive with it and move forward with the Dash 2 amendments to just remove that. And I know that you're wanting to try to capture the information to be able to provide it for future representation consideration of maybe, you know, collective bargaining, and then maybe also the possibility of clients wanting to have that information available to them, too, to seek assistance. But still, again, that's a problem. The Dash 3s, as I have done further research into it, keeps basically the same issue there, but now addresses the public records laws through 192.410 to 505. And as I studied those last night, the key piece to that, as I see, is the definition of person. And person is described in statute as anybody. So again, even the dash threes does not protect the people out there. And that, and that's, I got to say, that's a serious problem for me. If I got somebody that's got a criminal record that wants to know who's who. So I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on that.
Let me just take a shot at it first. And let me say first, I appreciate your concern, Rep. Olson. I will say that I'm not sure that home care workers are going to be real targets for burglars, given the kind of wages they earn. But I do appreciate your concern. And, you know, and I wish that we had gotten the dash three language into the original version, because, you know, what we have here is a situation in which we have existing public disclosure laws which allow this information to be available and to be available, you know, to an organization, you know, just to be really honest, like SEIU, if they decided at some point that they would want to work with these workers for organization. The public disclosure laws require the agency to release that information. And we decided, as we were talking about it, that really the best way to handle this, rather than have a red flag out there for somebody like Rep. Andy Olson, you know, would be to clarify, you know, in statute that we're talking about rights that are existing already and that, you know, would be no more than those rights. So I don't know, and Bob can do a better job of handling it from a lawyerly point of view.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, this topic did come up in our last discussions, and that's why you have that provision at the end of line 7 and on line 8, is that we were concerned that if it's necessary to have this language in the bill, since, in our view, this was already covered by the public records laws, it was necessary to have the language in the bill, then it should reference the public access laws so that it doesn't provide any more or less access than would be allowed under existing law. And our understanding is that that's what this does, and that's what legislative counsel told us that it did.
Okay, follow-up, Madam Chair, with that. So we move this bill forward and it becomes law, and I'm a bad guy. And I come to the Department of Human Services and I say I want a list of everybody. What's going to, by this amendment, restrict or prevent them from being able to give me that information? I don't say anything, but I'm just...
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, my understanding is that this language will not change whatever access Mr. Bad Guy would have under existing law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a suggestion with this. If it, again, like what I feel the intent is, Representative Dembro and Bob, concerning this bill, if in fact this section that we're talking about from the original bill is one, to provide a database for clients to access who's who out there, and two, to be able to have names and addresses out there for consideration for collective bargaining someday in the future, why don't you just narrow it to specifically that? And then it closes the door, because, again, I mean, I think if I were a home care worker, I really wouldn't want my name out there for anybody to grab.
Can I just respond to that? You know, there are provisions under the public disclosure law for any individual who wants to shield their name and address to be able to do so. I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
I do have more now.
Well, we've done a lot this morning, but I know we've got people here from the traumatic brain injury, and I know they want, I don't, I want them to be able to testify today. We also have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more people on this issue. And when is the floor session? 11:15. So can people stay past 10 this morning? Anybody who cannot? If we, you cannot? No, you have to go at 10?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So I guess I'm James and people from DHS, we don't have the fiscal, so we can't pass this out today. So we could ask the people from DHS to come and testify another day, if that would work for folks.
I can hold my questions till later hearing, Madam Chair, if you'd like.
Well, in case there needs to be an amendment, I guess I'd like at least the issues to be out there, not necessarily being able to resolve today, but at least if you have concerns, I'd like them to be out. But there were several people. Marcy, where's Marcy? Are you from out of Salem, or are you in Salem? You're in Salem, so you could come back. Deborah Brown, are you in Salem or out of Salem? Okay, we'll make sure you get to testify. Morgan, and you're in Salem, so you could come by. Okay, I just want to get as many issues out as we can so that they can be dealt with before we have another public hearing work session. So, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, how about if I just kind of throw this out and not
sure.
ask a specific question, just to get it on the record, and then we can address it later. Representative Dembrough, I guess my concern is probably focused mostly around the costs. Now, I'm assuming the difference, and you mentioned the roll-up costs, I'm assuming the difference between the $800,000 and $900,000 for the current biennium, once it gets started, we're going to be halfway through the biennium or more. And so the roll-up cost of $2.2 to $2.3 million for 11-13 is basically because the time frame is, would that be accurate?
I believe so, yes.
The cost for starting or expanding a program, I guess, is my greatest concern. I think of, like Oregon Project Independence, that deals with in-home care. And it's a program that we, you know, we struggle to sufficiently fund, and I'm just concerned about adding to another program of a similar service, in-home care, and then what? You know, are we really practically going to be able to afford $1 million this biennium and even more next? So,
And part of that discussion, I think, would happen in work session. So we can continue that discussion and when we open up a work session. Any other questions rather than opinions?
This is a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. And my question is around really how the workman's comp portion works in home. And I know we do that in other areas already, so I don't know how it works. As a business owner, for the last 18 years, I've been a purchaser of workman's comp insurance. And through that, I know there is training that has to be done, but there's also facility requirements and adjustments to be made to make where the people work safe so they don't get hurt. I'm wondering how that works and how it would specifically work with the disability folks.
Yeah,
I mean, they're going to be the employer in charge of the facility. How would they go about making sure their home was safe for a worker, and what oversight is done during that process?
Rep. Freeman, I really can't answer that question, but it's obviously something that is being dealt with now with the existing population, all the people, you know, the seniors and people with physical disabilities. And it's, I'm sure, something that the Home Care Commission has a lot of expertise on. And, you know, I think we can probably hear about that from James Taves or Cheryl Miller. They, you know, I'm sure they have a lot of experience.
Great. Good.
Madam Chair, just one quick,
well,
not to them, but to you.
Okay.
Is there somebody on SAFE that is going to testify on that particular issue? Because I asked Representative Dembrough yesterday, and he said that there wasn't. And you know, as much as James
and you'd
Tate
like
said,
to have some,
you know, he has expertise in SPD. He's not a workers' comp. You know.
So you're requesting to have somebody from SAFE come to
yes,
testify?
Yes, sure. That would
next
be really
hearing.
Helpful.
Can we arrange that? Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you. Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, Bob, Representative Dembrough, back to dash threes. And these are actually kind of more just administrative cleanup type questions. Page 3, subsection 3, so starting at line 20, describes the reason I bring this up, because I'm trying to get a handle on this a little bit, and maybe you can paint the picture for me a little bit better, but the commission shall consider the recommendations of the committee. Okay, so, you know, obviously the commission appoints, but then the commission shall inform the committee of the reasons for not following the recommendation side. That, I'm trying to recognize what other agency or commission committee has any type of wording like that, and it just seems to me a little confusing. So maybe can you explain to me why that piece is in there?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, out in the hallway, I was likening this to creating a new relationship. We have an existing group of people who are now being served, and we have a board that is used to overseeing the process for that population. We're bringing in new populations who are new to this arena and unsure about it. There's a lot of trepidation about this, and so what and that has led to the creation of an advisory committee of people who have specialized information about the developmental disabilities service system, which is quite different, again, and the mental health service system and consumers. This particular line that you pointed out is really a trust builder line, and which is there to just emphasize that if the full commission gets recommendations from the committee about developmental disabilities or mental health services, and they choose not to follow that they will at least inform the committee why they felt that it wasn't in the best interest of the program to do so. And it's there, as I said, as a trust builder to help move that process along. And so I think that's why it's there.
Okay. Just to comment on that one, Madam Chair, and then I have a question, an additional question. My personal opinion is I don't think it's necessary that to invite someone into the committee in itself should start to develop and should have a long time ago developed a relationship for trust. My next question then is the following, subsection 4, and it deals with appointing the members to the committee. And I'm looking at what section 2 of, which you don't have in front of you, but it is actually measure 99 back in 2000, and what the intent was of who the Home Care Commission operation selection was and those folks that are assigned to that. And my thoughts on that is it appears to me from what the voters had initially placed in measure 99 was sufficient enough that there wasn't really any need for section 4 for additional committee. I'm just trying to kind of correlate this and go by what we have in Constitution, because again, my concern here, just like what Representative Denbrough and I shared yesterday about policy, because I am stinky on policy because I like good policy, I'm just struggling with that and I'm kind of confused. So maybe if you can explain that to me.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, you have every right to be confused about this because it is inherently confusing. The voters did place a commission into the Constitution, but there is a question about whether what the voters did actually covered the developmental disabilities and the mental health populations or not. The Attorney General has weighed in on that question, and Mr. Taves can tell you about that process. But basically what the Attorney General said was that it's ambiguous for a variety of reasons as to whether that was intended or not. But the Attorney General came down and said, when you weigh everything together, we don't think that the Constitution covers these additional populations. So that's an AG opinion.
Okay.
But it acknowledges that you could kind of go, there's things that would lead you in different directions in making that conclusion. So So the overall concept here is that we have something that's mandated in the Constitution. The legislature is now adding some additional responsibilities onto a constitutionally created body and saying, while you're off doing your constitutionally mandated tasks, we'd also like you to do these additional tasks. And so in the context of doing those additional tasks, we would like you to have this special committee because these service systems are very different, and we need that additional expertise to come to the table, and we'd also like you to do some of these additional things while you're taking on these legislatively mandated new tasks.
Okay. Madam Chair, can I just ask one more?
Very quickly.
A very simple question.
Yes.
Thank you. Last session, we passed House Bill 2442 that requires background investigations. How is this going to play out to this?
Do you?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, the home care worker, as I understand it, and I want to call for Representative Gelzer to come in to give you all the details, but the home care workers are mandatory abuse reporters. There are abuse reporting systems that are separate. There's one for seniors and people with disabilities, and there's one for people with developmental disabilities and mental illnesses. And so abuse reporting can go to those different agencies. In terms of registering of individuals under that bill, I'm not exactly sure how it meshes into this one, and I haven't studied it, but I'd be happy to go look at it and tell you what I found.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. From having gone through at length last session dealing with House Bill 2442, it would appear that there's some serious potential of losing a lot of folks out there right now in the home health care environment for work because they failed the background.
Madam Chair, can I ask Bob one quick question? I know you're really, really quick, and this is something you can answer at a later time if you don't want to go all into it. With this population that you represent, if you were given $1 million a year to spend, would you spend it this way, or would you increase services to that population?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, I'm going to slightly duck that question by saying that, because, again, I'm representing people in this process, and what I have been told is what they're concerned about is that they do not lose services as a result of this. We haven't had the discussion about, if somebody gives us a bunch more money, how would we like to spend it? Somehow that doesn't seem to be a topic that's come up recently. But the concern has been, and you see it throughout all of these amendments and these statements of purpose, is that as we roll into this, individuals are concerned that their level of services, that their service model, if you will, is not disrupted by this rolling in. So
there has been some cut to some services, so it just seems odd that we're not buying back those services instead we're buying this. So that was my question. So thank you, and I appreciate the position you're in.
I might just add that the expectation is that many of the services will be improved by additional training and access and being able to find home care workers. Whether that happens with people who provide home care services who are family members is an open question in the minds of the folks that I have been working with.
Thank you so much, and thanks for staying through the grilling. Next, we're going to be hearing from Deborah Brown, Morgan Cowling, and Marcy Ingledew. Is that right? Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming this morning. Just start right ahead. As you sit down, just start talking. And please introduce yourself.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Brown. I have worked with in my aunt's and uncle's medical foster home for needy children for the last 14 years. I had experience with kids. I worked for 4 years in daycare before that. I thought I knew what I was doing. These kids that come into care have a lot of medical needs. Our kids have respiratory needs. They have ventilators. They have concentrators to give them oxygen. They receive 24-hour care from trained staff that we train while we're working. On the job, there is no paid training for us. Most of our tasks are delegated by a registered nurse, which is tube feedings and trach changes, and they have gastrostomy changes that we have to do. I love my job. I love the kids. I would do it forever. But we're getting older, and the kids are getting bigger, and they're getting stronger, and they hit harder, and they bite, and they pinch, and... Mm-hmm. That, I mean, you know, when we first started and the kids are little, it's, you know, it's one thing and they're 35 pounds, but in a couple years when they're 120 pounds and they're as tall as you and they don't quite walk yet and you're still helping to support them and it takes two people, it's a lot of work. And there's not enough workers. And the people that are coming in now that haven't been doing this as long as some of us are seeing what it is now, and it's harder. It's a lot harder. You're not getting the skilled professionals like you were. You don't have the people that are dedicated like we are because they don't care like we do. We haven't had health insurance or workman's comp, which I guess really wasn't that big of a deal to me because I didn't realize. But in 2006, I got really sick and found out that I had cancer. I don't have health insurance. I didn't have health insurance, and I didn't care because I was young, and it didn't make that big of a deal to me. However, because of that, I had to have surgery. If you don't have insurance, when you go to the doctor, you have to have down payments because you're private pay. So I was hospitalized, and then to find out if I had cancer, I had to have $1,500 down. That's nearly my whole month payment. I mean, really, we don't get paid that much. I'm really sorry. And then I had to have surgery to find out where the cancer was and all of that. I had to have more money down for the doctors for the hospital stay. I had a hysterectomy. I can't have kids. I've never had kids. I'm raising your kids every day, taking care of them. I get up early in the morning. I come to work. I get bathe them. I dress them. I feed them. I medicate them. We make sure that they have all their nebulizer treatments. They go to school beautifully dressed, clean, warm, healthy, happy. We have so much fun. We go to the movies. We go camping. We go shopping. We watch movies. We have popcorn. They have game nights. I work with my cousins. I work in my aunt and uncle's foster home. It's wonderful. My kids come to visit. I'm an adoptive mom now because I can't have my own children. And they're cousins. My kids don't call. Just because they weren't born there doesn't mean they don't belong there, and everybody is family. It's not a facility. It's a home. My aunt and uncle live there 24/7. It's a lot of work. And to not have the workman's comp for when we're hurt means that you don't get paid for time off. My cousin Sarah received a concussion from one of the kids because she was headbutted. And that you don't get paid for that. You don't get reimbursed for that, any of it. And there's nobody to call. There's nobody that, there's no resources. We don't. So that's why I'm here. It scares me because these kids are getting bigger and there's more kids coming into care and their medical conditions are more complicated than they have been. And there's going to be trouble. These kids don't need to live in the hospital. That's not okay. And that's really where they would be, in a facility with people that really don't care that they would get their basic needs, but not the love and support that they should have from a family like they could have. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you for coming today. Thank you for the work you do, and thank you for sharing with us.
Thanks.
Deborah, how many children are in the foster home where you work?
Right now, eight.
Eight. And so how many workers are there?
I believe 12, but we also have 3 registered nurses.
In addition to the 12?
In addition to the 12 staff, yes.
I see, and that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
My aunt is a registered nurse, and so she lives in the homes, but if she needs to go out to go to the store, to go to the movies, to go to take another kid to the doctor, then we have to have a nurse in the home for one of our children.
There has to be a nurse there 24/7?
One of our children, yes.
Okay.
Requires a registered nurse 24/7, yes.
Thank you, Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions of Deborah? Very compelling story. Thank you for bringing reality to this building today.
Absolutely.
Thank
you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for what you do.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the House Human Services Committee. My name is Morgan Cowling, and I'm here today representing the Association of Oregon Counties and the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I'm here today to talk about the -3 amendments to House Bill 3618, and I know our time is limited, but I'd like to give just a little short background on how this bill interplays with what counties are currently doing around both mental health and developmental disabilities. So to start, boards of county commissioners are the local mental health authority, and in this role have authority over local mental health, addictions, and developmental disabilities programs. In this role, counties play quality assurance, coordination, and planning functions for mental health, addictions, and developmental disabilities. In addition, counties deliver services directly to clients who need mental health and addiction services and provide case management services for developmental disability clients. Some counties have chosen to work with private nonprofits, but regardless of who provides the services, counties are still responsible for that planning and oversight functions. For counties, this bill would impact several Medicaid waiver programs for both DD and mental health clients. I want to be clear that counties have a role in developmental disabilities separate from that of the brokerages. The home care workers that this bill pulls under the Home Care Commission are not currently county employees. However, county case managers work with the families and people with developmental disabilities to develop a plan that works for those DD clients. There's some initial concerns from our DD program managers that this bill had the potential to reduce services to already limited services to our DD community. And another concern that this bill would change the relationship between the county and the home care workers to create more of an employer relationship. And talking with the advocates and Representative Dembro, we understand the intent of the bill is not to have counties take on that employer role, but really to have the home care community work through the Home Care Commission for the workers' comp claims and help resolve those issues. It is also important to note that this bill also has counties report our mental health home care workers who perform services under Personal Care 20. The ability for our mentally ill clients to stay in their homes means the difference between community care and more expensive institutional care like the Oregon State Hospital. It is very important that we make sure that this bill doesn't reduce services to clients. Just as Representative Dembro mentioned, and we are hopeful that the language in the -3 amendments around the legislative intent of these that Mr. June Duff went through help alleviate our concerns about those potential service reductions. We would really like to thank Representative Dembro for working diligently with advocates to bring forward the amendments to make improvements in this bill. We would particularly like to thank him for his attention to the advisory committee. In the -3s, we have a consumer or family member for both the DD community and the mental health community, and we think that bringing those two together is a very important part of this advisory committee. Also, because the brokerages have a role separate from what the counties are doing as a public agency, we would each both have a seat on that advisory committee as well, which we think would be very helpful. We look forward to working with the Home Care Commission and the Department of Human Services as this moves forward to make sure that we are working together, talking together, and making sure that we're not reducing services to the clients who are most in need. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any quick questions of Morgan? Thank you so much, Morgan.
Good morning, Representative Tomei, Chair Tomei, and the members of the committee. My name is Marcy Ingledew, and today I'm here to represent the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. I know in January, Margaret Tyson, who is the chair, met with you and probably gave you a little bit more information than I will today since we are on a limited time. In addition, I'm also the executive director of the ARC of Oregon, and we're a member organization of the DD Coalition. And my most important role, I think, as always, is as a parent of a young gentleman with developmental disabilities who's just recently turned 18 and is just now accessing the adult service system, and is something that is very important to us, and so it'll be something that we experience personally. I appreciate all the comments that Morgan made, and would reiterate that is truly, those are our concerns also, and we really do appreciate the work that's been done on the Dash 3 amendments, and can support the bill with those Dash 3 amendments. It is important that as the support service brokerages came into existence over the last 10 years, that this has always been a concern for us, particularly for the families that are becoming the employers of record. And so it is very important that this has been a concern for us, and the fact that this bill has come forth has been helpful, although there is great apprehension. As you have said yourself, it is a very complicated bill. A number of service delivery systems that are represented and run differently. And so we just want to make sure that we do realize that the Dash 3 amendments are very, very important to this for us. In addition, the fact that, as Representative Dembro talked about, the closure of institutions and bringing individuals back into the community is apparent, is the highest position that we'd want to take as far as making sure that individuals are within our community and are productive citizens and have the supports that they needed. Not only is it important and is our values as who we are as organizations and the coalition, it's important that it also saves the state a lot of money that way, and it's very important to us. So we greatly support the Dash 3 amendments, and instead of going on and reiterating what Morgan said, definitely that is the position that we would also take. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Any of these witnesses? Thank you all very much. Thank you, especially Deborah.
Thank you.
Okay, we do have time for James and Richard, if he's still here, and Cheryl Sanders. And I'm going to ask you gentlemen to make it a little short. Probably you would like that too. And we can always bring you back if there are more questions than we can get to today. Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, the Senior and People with Disabilities Division. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do today is, because we've worked a lot with the stakeholders and Representative Dembro and others on the amendments to really improve this bill. It is very complicated, and we understand that. So, and let me just say that I spent 4 years as a direct care worker rather early in my career when I was somewhat younger, and I can attest from a lot of personal experience that direct care workers do extraordinary work. And frequently in our systems are undervalued and underpaid. And so I think that kind of goes without saying. The one thing I want to address, there's lots of language in this bill about protecting client benefits and making sure that as we add workers' comp, and presumably if there's collective bargaining down the road, we add wages, benefits, health care, or anything else, that somehow does not then automatically turn around and translate into cuts in direct services to offset the expanded costs for worker wages or benefits. And I think that language really attempts to assure the stakeholder community that that would be the case. I want to make very clear, though, this is an interest arbitration group. So in the event that we go to collective bargaining eventually and we bargain additional wages and benefits and the state does not agree or doesn't have the money, we would then end up going to interest arbitration. And then a decision would be made that, of course, at the end of the day is binding. And I think the intent is hopefully in that process to weigh the relative issues in terms of the public interest, as well as whether finances are available to do that, as well as the welfare of the clients themselves. But I think that's kind of my role, is just a cautionary note here about the future costs of this. We'll deal with the specifics of the fiscal in the next couple of days. It's hopefully under, I think we're still under $1 million for this biennium, and next biennium about $2.5 million. Those are pre-collective bargaining costs. Those are just the costs of ramping up training, the staffing of this, starting to work on the registry and the workers' compensation piece of that. So I just wanted that to be clear. And I also want to emphasize again, we are heading over a cliff in the next biennium for SPD alone. We'll have anywhere from $300 to $400 million to backfill after the federal stimulus goes away. And so that's not just a concern about this bill. It's a concern about all of our programs. And no language in this bill will assure that client benefits would be left untouched if we face that kind of severe financial crisis in the future. And the interest, the position we'll be put in is if the governor does not put, if we head down the road towards collective bargaining, if the governor doesn't put separate pots of dollars for just bargaining purposes, if, as has been in the last couple biennium, even cost of living adjustments are stripped out of our programs given the fiscal situation, then we'll go to the table in those kind of cases with nothing to offer. And so the process of negotiation would occur. And we would come back to you all. We would come back to the legislature if, in fact, through binding arbitration, costs are added and it's not previously budgeted. We would have to return to you anyway to say, you know, here's these additional costs on this side, and either we cut this program or we refinance that. So it will be a legislative position. And so I think having clear legislative intent here about your wishes in wanting to protect and weigh those client benefits against increased costs in other places, I think, are very, very important. So with that, until the detailed fiscal comes out, I think I'll just leave it at that and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think we're going to hear from everybody before we open up for questions right now. So, Richard?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Harris. I'm the Assistant Director for Addictions and Mental Health in DHS. I want to thank the committee and the people working on this for recognizing that there are a small number, but a significant population of people that have mental illness that are included in this bill, and that we have to recognize that it affects not only the SPD clients, but also those with mental illness. And so we're ready to be working on this in any way we can to support the bill. I have some of the same financial concerns that Mr. Tays has presented here. I just wanted to raise one other additional issue, which we don't know this, but certainly the past experience was when new people came in to the commission that there was an issue about parity in wages, and that many of the people that are working in our system now are perhaps working at a lower wage than individuals that are covered under the commission. And so it is going to raise the issue about how we deal with those wage increases to get to a level of parity. And we haven't, that's not part of the cost that we have now, but we do need to figure this out. So I think as we get more detailed cost impact statements here, we need to think about that. I do believe, though, that it's very clear that the services provided in home are vital to helping people stay out of institutional care, and that's a major concern for the mental health system, is to make sure we're providing the best level of care we can in the community to keep people there and to keep them out of more expensive institutional care. So, and it makes sense to have a healthy workforce and a better skilled workforce. And to the extent that we can achieve those goals here, that helps us meet our mission about keeping people in the community. So if there's anything later, we'll be glad to be back here when we talk about costs.
Thank you, Richard. Cheryl, it's good to see you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Miller. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Home Care Commission. The Home Care Commission, over the years, has been really involved with training. And one of the things that has not really been mentioned is this bill will also provide training for the consumer employer. And we've talked a lot about the providers, but the commission also has some of the same concerns that everybody else does. Of course, you know that, and I had a statement, but I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but I'll say this part. Despite all of what you know about the commission, the good work that has happened, the training, the registry that helps people find home care workers that best match their service needs, the testimonies that we get every month from consumers who have been through the STEPS training that is provided by the Centers of Independent Living around the state, we still are concerned about the funding that will be required for us to meet our duties and responsibilities in this bill and the duties that the departments, port brokerages, counties, and other entities will have. And we know that we are in difficult times, and the commission wants to ensure that adequate hours of services are provided to seniors and persons with disabilities, and that the services and the goods, including adult support services, are not compromised or diminished as a result of this bill. And so those are our concerns. We think this is important. We believe in workers having workers' compensation and training. We know what it's done to the population that we currently serve. And so I think we're just thinking along the same lines as everyone else.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Any quick questions? And what I'd like to do, colleagues, since our time is running out, is for you to present the questions, and I will have the panel come back to answer those questions later, but at least they'll know what you're going to want responses to. Representative Dimbro?
Madam Chair, thank you. And, you know, please, I'd encourage any of my colleagues to, if you have any questions, shoot them to me, and I'll try to get the answers or get people here who can provide testimony.
Great.
Thank you.
Representative Freeman.
And this is fine to be answered later. Do you all look to have additional funding for this, or do you think you can absorb the cost within your existing budgets?
Madam Chair, you want us to answer?
You can get back to me later.
Well, get back okay. Later. Okay. And Representative Olson had to go to testify in another committee, so he asked me to ask these two questions. I think there were two. So do you know the cost to the state when the general population of seniors and people with disabilities became a unit under collective bargaining, and how many people did that involve? So you can answer that later. The other one was, I think, should the mentally ill, developmental disability and mentally fragile children become representative by a collective bargaining unit, do you know what the cost would be? Ballpark, I think, is what he's asking for. So if you could come back with that. Any other questions you want answered?
Richard had mentioned, and maybe we heard it in the last committee hearing, Madam Chair, but how many clients are we looking at? Richard
good.
Had said a
Very
small
good.
Number, and so I'd like a number on that.
The methodology for determining how many people would be brought in to the system? Because I know we don't know.
Good.
It would be nice to know.
Yeah, good. Any other quick questions? Thank you so much for coming today, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you again.
Thank you.
Okay. Was there anybody else to coming to testify on this? Great. If not, we will close the public hearing on 3618. And Okay, I know I'm going to lose one person at 10. Colleagues, I'm going to do something because the speaker has asked me to do this. Let's pass this out.
Okay.
He has asked me to introduce a committee bill, and I'm going to ask you to vote on this morning. It's regarding, I guess I open up a public hearing, on BPA, and it's for in baby bottles and in sippy cups. That's right. And so all it does is introduce this bill in this committee. That doesn't mean that you're committed to this. We will be having more hearings on it, but he just asked us to introduce it. I'd just like to take a couple of minutes to do that. So,
Madam Chair, is this the same bill that they're hearing in the Senate?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So now I open up a work session. Work session on LC 239. Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that LC 239 be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Boone moves that LC 239 be introduced as a committee bill. I know there will be discussion and questions later. I'd sure appreciate it if we could just pass this today and we'll hear more about it later. Is that okay?
Madam Chair, if you said that on every bill, maybe you...
Okay, no discussion. Any... what's the other word? Any...
objection.
Objection. Thank you, Representative Boone. Any objection? So done. LC 239 will be introduced as a committee bill. Thank you. Okay, we will have... What's that? Okay, we will open up an informational hearing on 3692, right? Traumatic brain injury.
Why? 3692. Okay.
Oh, well, then we'll open up a hearing after if there's time.
Okay. Okay. All right. And Senator Morissette. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of this august, esteemed committee.
How's that?
That's pretty impressive.
You're almost there.
Thank you.
Yeah, you almost got unanimous consent.
Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, Lane and Linn County. There's some information that is being distributed concerning House Bill 3692, which has to do with traumatic brain injury. It's a funding mechanism. I've been working on this since, I think, 99. Bill Olson was the first person to get me involved, and I've been involved ever since. Sherry Stock is the director of the Traumatic Brain Injury Commission. And it is a commission?
Association.
Association. Okay. Anyway, on Sunday, David Saracen may have an article in the Oregonian talking about the Super Bowl and the headhunters and the brain damage that may occur. I talked to him yesterday, and we talked about football. We had a bill at Max's Law, which does require that the coaches understand the symptoms and not put somebody back in the game until they've been thoroughly examined by a qualified medical person. We didn't do anything about the helmets, which we wanted to do. That was an unfunded mandate, so they dropped that from the bill. But the important thing is the recognition of traumatic brain injury. General Caldwell is in the room. We've had this discussion with him. They've even made some liners for helmets for the soldiers from the National Guards, people from Oregon, to help protect them. Brain injury can be caused by whiplash. The woman who was killed in the ski slopes last year had whiplash, caused bleeding in the brain. She died. If it had been taken care of immediately, she would have survived. Brain injury is caused by a series of falls or hits to the head over a period of time, and they're finding that out now with retired professional football players. Brain injury is caused by being punched in the face in the boxing ring, which, and the goal of that is to render someone unconscious. In other words, the goal of boxing is to give somebody a brain injury, knock them out. So we live in a very brutalized sports world, and my concern is that people are not aware of the causes of traumatic brain injury, how we identify people, how we track them, how we get a registry that lets us know who they are and how their treatment is going. On the commission, on the association board, there is a doctor and a lawyer, both of whom have traumatic brain injury, neither of whom can practice in their profession. You can't tell by looking or by talking to them, though, that they have a brain injury, but it did. And they were caused by falls and I believe by falls and accidents. Yeah. So that's what this is all about, and it's a very, very important issue. And we did find a mechanism to help fund the program. And our purpose is to get the word out. Now, it's interesting because I received a phone call from the Brain Injury Association in New Jersey and Connecticut. And I had them call Sherry to tell them how we got this thing started. And we've since had calls from other states. So it's extremely important. And for your loved ones who may have fallen down and bumped their head a few times, they may have symptoms of traumatic brain injury, even though it has come on gradually. And these are the really important things. We did pass a bill in 2003 that had to do with children under 15 having to wear helmets when they ride skateboards, scooters, inline skates. Yeah, bicycle was already there. But I see kids that are not doing that. And there is a $25 fine, but I'm trying to get the EMTs and the people who helped pass that bill to remind people. So it is a very important issue. So with that, I will stop, and if you have any questions for me, I will try to answer. And Sherry is the fount of knowledge and wisdom.
Great. Why don't we hear from Sherry, and then we'll ask questions. Yeah. Welcome, Sherry.
Hi, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. And this bill would do is take $5 on traffic violations, put it into a special fund unless a judge takes that away. But there's always that option; the judge could take it away. That brain injury fund then would fund services for people with brain injury, and those services could be, for instance, the TBI registry. It could be pre-release TBI program. Right now, people are coming out of the prisons with brain injury. They go into a day program anywhere from 5 days to 3 years to try and get them back into society, working in society. And they have a difficult or impossible time with people with brain injury because their problems are so severe and they don't specialize in that. And another would be day programs to teach people how to control anger and behavioral problems, return to work programs, case management, family assistance for National Guard, returning military have a high rate of brain injury. The U.S. government is admitting to at least 20%, and that's a huge number. Oregon VA now has a polytrauma unit that is the TBI PTSD polytrauma unit, and in the last 3 months, they've had over 700 veterans come in from Iraq and Afghanistan with traumatic brain injury, which before they had labeled as delayed reentry adjustment issues. They now realize it's traumatic brain injury, so they're starting to flood the system. It's been long enough now that people realize there's something wrong with these guys. They're violent. They're family violence, domestic violence is increasing. Shaken baby is increasing. Random acts of violence and anger is increasing, and it's because of the brain injury and the returning veterans. And the reason we are choosing motor vehicle accidents or motor vehicle tickets is because 49% of all people being served by the state have received their injury in a motor vehicle accident, their traumatic brain injury, and that's moderate to severe. Now, my son, we were hit when he was 3 months old by a drunk driver, seventh DUI. My son at 3 months old will always be an 18-month-old, always. He is potty trained, though. And he's 42 years old, 6'3", and he's an 18-month-old. And that should not have ever happened, but it is what it is. So the deaths from TBI are huge, children getting hurt. It's a problem of awareness, but the awareness is increasing. And it's because of our current war, and it's because of what's happening in NFL. So more people are being identified with a brain injury, which is usually one of the last codings, because you go in there and you have a concussion, maybe a bleed in the brain that's overlooked, but you have a broken arm and a broken leg, maybe a ruptured spleen. So the brain injury is just ignored. It just, you don't even see that for months or years later. And approximately 20,000 Oregonians have a brain injury of some sort. More than 670 will die in Oregon alone. And 32% of all the TBIs that require hospitalization are a direct result of motor vehicle accidents. And why aren't people identified even more? It's because there's so many things that even physicians are missing concussions. And so it's an education and awareness that is a part of this legislation, is to build education and awareness. It's also a part, we would have a committee made up of people from DHS, and that would be funded by a halftime position. That halftime position would be paid for out of the funds that come in, so there would be no cost to the state. Whatever is a cost there would be to the state would be covered by the funds coming in. And on that committee would be the director of the Oregon Health Authority, Veterans Affairs, the director of corrections, the adjutant general, Bob Junedef, Disability Rights Oregon, would be on it, and someone with a brain injury or a family member, too. This is a huge problem the state has, and this is a small way to answer the issues. Also, with this money coming in, we could leverage that money to use it as a funding to get more grants, federal grants. So there would be the funding there without taking it out of general fund to leverage for more funding to get grants to cover, to create a TBI registry or other programs.
Thank you, Sherry. Mm-hmm. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sherry or Senator, either one, trying to remember from last session the discussion on this, and I remember the mechanism identified for assessment on traffic fines. But I'm not remembering the $5. Is the $5 different than what we were looking at last session?
Actually, it was recommended that we increase that to $5. We did have $2, and Washington State has realized that $2 was not enough, and with recommendations from some of the representatives here on the committee, we raised that to $5.
Follow-up? Okay. So basically, upon investigation, it was increased to $5 to do the job that we were really shooting to do,
exactly,
based on Washington's model.
Exactly.
And it is at the discretion of the judge.
Olson?
And it is definitely at the discretion of the judge. So
the $5.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I didn't read that in here.
That's good.
Is that it?
Not at all.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sherry, Senator, good to see you. A couple really quick questions, because what's driving this a little bit for me is I have contact with my circuit court judges down in both Lynn and Benton counties on a regular basis from my background and everything. But I think it was House Bill 2274-75 last year that we passed that increased the surcharges, mm-hmm, if you remember, that was actually the Chief Justice was needing that for helping us out with the court expenses as well. It was $35 for misdemeanors and $45 respectively then for traffic violations. This $5 is discretionary, so it's not a minimum mandatory, is what I'm hearing you say?
It's not meant to be.
Okay, so it's, wow. Do you have any follow-up, Madam Chair?
Maybe we ought to amend it. Minimum.
Well, here's the point being is that actually the volume of citations are going down right now in the state. And as a result of that, the revenue that was anticipated is not even getting close. I mean, it's actually going the other direction now. And it's created some more serious problems within the criminal justice community for the court structure. So what I'm just kind of curious if you had kind of thought of what maybe your revenue stream might be looking at, you know, as you pursue the $5?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we did do a fiscal last year, and it was probably going to be about $1.5 million biannually. So we're not talking a lot of money. And
And that was with $2.
It is a shell.
Yeah, it just came in
instead of a May.
It was a shell.
Yeah. That's on page 3, section 9, I believe.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Yeah. Right, section. Yeah. Okay.
It is a shell.
So it's mandatory minimum. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. General Caldwell, why don't you come up, and we should hear from you before ask any more questions. And Representative Boone, is that okay with you? And we'll hold off. Feel free to stay, Senator.
I need to get ready.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. We appreciate hearing from you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Reagan Military Department. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And respect the effort that this committee and the legislature is making in this area. Just kind of as a background, as was indicated earlier in some of your earlier testimony, the National Guard, we've had a significant number of deployments since 2001. Right now we're at about individually, first give you the idea, the scope of our force. Army National Guard in Oregon is 8,500 people. Air National Guard is about 2,200. So we got about 9,700 folks that are typically in the Oregon National Guard. As of the first of the year, we had deployed over 14,000 individual deployments. Some have gone 2-3 times, but statistically, we're just about twice through our force. So we've had a good number of folks deploy into the combat theaters over the last several years. Currently, we have about 3,100, we got more than that. We got about 3,500 people between Afghanistan and Iraq. The majority of those will be home in May. About 3,100 of them will be home in May. So right now, we're tracking, not counting the anything that may be in theater, right now we're tracking 65 known, not moderate TBI, but severe TBI cases in our force. That's membership. Those are folks that are currently in the force. We have another probably 100 to 150 that have since gotten out, finished their term of enlistment, elected not to return or couldn't return because of medical issues and have taken a disability through the Veterans Affairs, and we don't track those any longer. Army-wide, it was indicated earlier, I have a chart that was just put out here in January. And as of just this last year in the Army alone, and not counting the other services, there was over 20,000 people who self-identified or were identified through a command that they had an issue. The Army is concerned about this. All the services are. It's averaging roughly about 500 to 600 identifications per month inside the United States Army right now. So it's a major issue. The Army is working very diligently and very hard at this point to identify this problem and also educate people, particularly leaders and other soldiers, on what to look for and how to identify this, because most people don't recognize it on their own. They don't
it takes a while to figure it out, as Sherry indicated, and they don't understand, you know, what's going on, so they don't say anything. So it's not culturally a thing that they want to admit. So there's a big effort now that before people are deployed, we have training sessions. When they get to their mobilization station, they have more sessions, and then they do it in theater as well. So there's three different stops on the way back. There's two different stops where we do a health assessment. Actually, there's three. The third one when they get home to Oregon. So there's a good deal of effort going forward, which I think explains some of the numbers and the increase, is that we're trying to identify, you know, these folks that have this injury or potentially have the injury, because the key to any success in the future is immediate solid treatment. And there aren't treatment facilities. The nearest one for us is at Fort Lewis, which does make it a problem when a person comes off of active duty. They don't want to stay at Fort Lewis. They want to come home. Mm-hmm. So they typically don't do a very good job of self-identification. They know that if they identify any injury, regardless of what it is, that they're going to be held at Fort Lewis. So then it comes back to the community. They return to civilian life. And then we see them either in the local county mental health system, county jail system, or some other system that we have here in the state. We've changed some of our way of operations by having Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, Mr. Willis and his people at the demobilization processing to get these people to sign up in the VA, in the federal VA, and force that issue so we can get them enrolled so they're eligible for this VA treatment that's offered here at the Portland VA and also at Fort Lewis. We do that for a host of reasons, but primarily because it doesn't make a lot of sense that the system that's currently operational in Oregon, the mental health system, any of our systems are fragile. It doesn't make sense that we would dump these people into it in a system that's already stretched. So we're doing our best to try to get every single person. To give you an example, we had a unit just returned from Iraq, 125 people. Out of the 125 people, 121 of them got signed up. Four of them didn't. The four that didn't, I went back and asked, why didn't we get the other four? Well, they were delayed at their mobilization station. They didn't come home with the unit. They're still back there because of other injuries. One had a knee, one had a mental health issue, and the other two were, I think, elbows, shoulders, who I don't know all the details, but they just didn't get back to Oregon yet. We'll get them. So we're working really, really hard to get these people signed up in the Veterans Administration so they can get this service when they get out. We didn't do that good a job at the initial stage of the war. We didn't know what we didn't know. And I think we've done a lot better job since then, and we've had a lot of help from a lot of different agencies and groups like Sherry's to try to make people aware of this issue and get all kinds of the issues coagulated into one spot so the right people can take care of it and these soldiers can get the treatment that they deserve and they need. So that's kind of a summary of where we're at with respect to what we're doing at this point. I guess a better graphic example of what's happened to the Oregon Guard. In 2001, we had three people doing our medical stuff full-time, three full-time people. One was two officers, both nurses, and an administrator, and a clerk. Today, we've got 65 people doing that. To kind of give you an idea of what's happened to our system, this is all federally supported. It comes from the National Guard Bureau with the Department of Defense, and they're supporting this, which is the good news. Took a while to build that up, but that just gives you an idea. Of course, we had no place to put them because we don't build buildings for that. We build buildings for what we know we have, and all of a sudden, we were moving lockers out, and we were converting locker rooms into office space and everything else because we had no place to put these folks, but we needed them just to handle the medical side of the operation, whether you're going or coming back, and we simply weren't structured for that. And with all these deployments, we suddenly realized that we pushed back to the National Guard Bureau and said, we've got to have more folks to handle this volume. So that's just kind of a good graphic example of what's happened to our organization in the last 9 years. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, General. Representative Boone, I know you have a question.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask if in your plan, Sherry, if you take a page out of the military's book, and do this sort of outreach and, identify as much as, or help people in the field, so to speak, in which would I would imagine be the EMTs and fire departments, police departments, because you're going to, and schools, obviously, you're going to get people, Senator Morissette talked about falls, and I just heard of a constituent of mine who years ago took a fall, it's a truck driver, off, when he was doing a load, securing a load, and tripped and fell off onto his head. Nobody found him. He was out for, he figured, 45 minutes, and I don't know how many years ago, but now he's having problems. And it first manifested itself in a physical shuffle or something, how he walked. But then he went on and on and on and never got it checked out or anything, and now he's having some serious medical problems. But they rack their brains trying to figure out, how did this happen? And they came up with possibly that fall, and I'll bet you anything that that's what it is. But, you know, Senator Morissette talked about games and sports and things like that, and everybody knows that. But I just think that if we, and thank you, General Caldwell, for doing your part and keeping your people as healthy as possible, but I just think the educational outreach part would be really valuable too, and I'm sure you might already be doing that.
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, yeah, that's a part of the bill, is information and referral awareness and educational outreach. And as the Brain Injury Association, we already do that. We work pretty closely with corrections and training corrections, and it's because they're overwhelmed with it. And what's happening with everything is brain injury, the awareness of brain injury is increasing drastically. The identification has increased by 25%, and it's not that there's 25% more people having brain injury, it's the awareness of it has increased. And that's in corrections, and it's in the schools that we now know that most children identified as ADD or really traumatic brain injury and need a different way of teaching, and that was covered under a bill in 05 that we passed to help with that, and it's doing fantastic. But you know, outreach and education and awareness is huge. It's huge for medical professionals. It's huge for people, for ER docs. I mean, it's across the board. People need to know. They are finding out that people that they think have Alzheimer's, dementia, that when they do brain scans, they find lesions on the brain that are old brain injury. So they have had traumatic brain injury. And it is very similar at that age.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, in the report that I've got that I was just received this week, it has in here a study commissioned by the NFL reports that Alzheimer's disease and similar memory-related disease appears to have been diagnosed in the league's former players vastly more often than the national population, including a rate of 19 times the normal rate for men ages 30 to 49. And that was from the University of Michigan Institute of Social Research. So they just completed that report, and I think you've seen a lot of talk about that in the NFL. We know that the real trick to getting good results is early treatment, early identification and early treatment. And if you can do those two things, then you're going to get a better result. And we had a soldier who initially, when 4 or 5 years ago or six when I met Sherry, this was not talked about in the military. And we had a soldier who came home. His wife called me, and she called me and said, there's something wrong with my husband. And I knew her because she had worked on our family program while these people were deployed. And she said, I can't get anybody to help. And we struggled with that individual. He was a manager for a distribution company in Boise, Idaho, was making probably $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. He couldn't remember to get out the door in the morning. He couldn't go back to his job. He lost his job. And the military was basically saying, well, you're okay. And we tried to reenter him back into the federal system to get him treatment. They wouldn't do it. It took us over a year. I saw him. I'm going to see him again tomorrow. But I saw him about 6 months ago in Ontario, and I called his wife, said, you guys be there tomorrow. I want to see him. And he was getting better, but he was making sandwiches now in a sandwich shop, and his wife drops him off every morning and picks him up. And he's probably at about 9-10 year old is capability. And here's a man who was making a good living, had a good young guy, 35 years old. And I'm real curious to see how he remembered me, which was, he remembers things, but he can't remember to get up every morning and get his clothes on and get to work. So she has to help him out and do that.
Yeah.
So,
magic.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, thank you so much. We are having an informational hearing, as you can see from your agenda, because we weren't sure we were going to have a bill, but we do have the bill. So I'm going to close the informational hearing and open up the public hearing. And I don't think we're ready for a work session. But Sherry, could you talk specifically about the bill that you brought forward?
Madam Chair and committee members, so the purpose of the bill is to not only create information and referral and an advisory committee brought together of a cross-section of departments, because people with brain injury don't have just a physical disability or a mental disability. They might have mental issues on top of it, PTSD. They might have physical issues. They might be blind. You can lose your vision. You can have ringing in your ears and lose your hearing. You have all sorts of different things. Brain injury doesn't come only from a hit on the head. It can come from toxic mold. It can come from cancer. We're curing people from cancer that we've never cured before, and the massive doses of chemotherapy that go through their body hurts the brain as well, so they come out with brain injury symptoms as well. So that's called an acquired brain injury. And so what this bill tries to do is to take some funding and put it into an awareness campaign, into a fund that can be used by this advisory council. They will decide how it will be used, and we included corrections in that because it's such a huge part of the problem. And homelessness is a huge part of the problem. 80% of all people homeless have a brain injury. And I do a lot of stand-downs. That's military resource fairs. And it's mainly homeless veterans. And in Springfield, I did a stand-down. They had 400 homeless families, all military people, come and attend this. And a lot of them had brain injury, but they wouldn't admit it because they needed to go back to into action to get enough money to support their families because they had no job. So their families, while they were home, were living in tents or in cars. And so what this bill would attempt to do is identify these problems, bring them to light, and help leverage funding to fund this and get programs in place that can help people as quickly as possible to get back in the system. It would also support groups, which are really vital for people with brain injury to have support and family members to share what they've got with each other.
Okay. I just want to follow up one question, Sherry, with you. During the informational meeting, you mentioned a percentage number for TBI in motor vehicle accidents. What was that percentage?
49% of all people that are a cost to the state, that's from moderate to severe, it's from motor vehicle accidents.
Okay. And then just one other thought. A question I have is, why have you only focused on just traffic violations, mainly because of that reason?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Boone?
Thank you. And just in that vein, I think what I'm getting at, too, is I understand that you're doing the outreach and education for people who and their families who may have had a traumatic brain injury. I'm concerned about some of the, especially in the rural areas, some of the fire departments. Sometimes it might fall just to the people who happen to respond to a specific, and we'll just use a traffic accident. If somebody at that scene, when they respond, even if it's only two people, doesn't ask, did you have your seatbelt on? Did you hit your head? And if you hit your head, sometimes you don't know. I'm getting at, is there a specific effort to reach out to those first responders who may come upon somebody, they find somebody unconscious? For example, our rural fire departments get calls, not all the time, but often, for it just comes as a person lying on the side of the road or a person down in the Safeway store or something like that. You don't know if they had a heart attack or what, or if they tripped and fell and bonked their head on something, and that's, you know, and then they're down, and by the time they respond, they say they're conscious and breathing. So what I'm concerned about is that that gets skipped over, and, oh, they're okay, they just flipped out. So that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Representative okay. Boone. Lisa Miette, actually, from the Department of Health and Epidemiology is here and could answer a lot of that. But we do intend to, and we are doing educational outreach. These funds would help us do that, which right now we are a one-person office that is trying to cover the entire state on donations alone. So my time is limited, even though I do work 7 days a week. There's only one of me. So with funding, then that would help the Department of Health as well get out and do training, which they do. But it would give them further funding. So I know that Lisa is available to answer any questions if you would like to have her come up.
It sounds like you're on the right track. And I understand the one person. Yeah. We're kind of like that.
Yeah.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair. I am curious, not so much curious as I would like, if possible, for you at some point or some group to present the various lists of potential injuries that you gave down. You went down the list very quickly about the kinds of injuries that people have been dealing with. I know of several myself in terms of my family members. And they were not on your list, so it was curious for me. But it would be good to have that available to teachers, to principals, to coaches about the kinds of things that they should look for, because in many cases they are passed over without any knowledge that this might even be a concern. One thing comes to mind for me is. The combination of a brain injury and medication that can cause more problems than you even think about, but people may not know that's something that they're taking right now. If they have a physical injury, may also have an impact on them even more, may multiply the impact. So those kinds of things I think would be helpful. And I'd love to be able to make sure that we get that information out. So thank you.
Representative Frederick, you're right. When I leave here, I'm on my way to the hospital. I have a 30-year-old man in a coma right now. He had a traumatic brain injury, was self-medicating, which is very common. So he was doing meth and went into cardiac arrest and had an anoxic brain injury. So he's now been in a coma and on the Oregon Health Plan and in the hospital for 3 weeks now. So I'm meeting his mother and to talk about, what the options are and what the future looks, which is not good in this case. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention, the language problems or that you could have a brain injury from a stroke because there's just so many different ways to have a brain injury and so many, but I will get you that information.
It is being sent
with the passage of Senate Bill 348, which is, by the way, being used as a federal model, so that federal bill might come down on the Oregon sports concussion. We have sent out almost 15,000 Centers for Disease Control kits to coaches throughout the state.
Excellent.
Every single soccer coach has received one of these kits and is getting training. So we are, with the CDC, so your federal dollars are being put to well use here in Oregon.
Any further questions? Thank you, Chair. Okay, if Lisa Millett and also David Crack would come up. Hey, David, was that correct pronunciation? Correct. Okay. Thank you. Lisa, if you want to go ahead and start.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Mia, and I manage the Injury and Violence Prevention Section in the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology, and that's in Public Health in the Oregon Health Authority. We do a lot of work crunching data in our office, and one of the things that I wanted to bring to the table today, actually 2 points, and I won't read my testimony, I'll say there's been an alarming 24% increase in hospitalization due to TBI in the last, between 2000 and 2007. And those statistics come from our hospitalization data that the Hospital Association provides to us. They are the tip of the iceberg. We have no idea how many TBIs are identified and treated in emergency departments. We have no idea how many are treated and identified in ambulatory care units. The state has no way of measuring magnitude and scope of this problem. It'd be really difficult to try to plan services, either the amount or where to have them or what they should be without an additional data source. We've talked with the Brain Injury Association and others about establishing authority within the Health Division to develop a brain injury registry. Right now, there will be federal grants available again to do that work, probably in the next fiscal year federally, not this coming one, one after. If we had authority on the books to do that, we could apply for these grants. And I think that that is all I wanted to talk about. We feel like, and we know that people that are working on the advisory council idea would really value and benefit from data that we could produce because of that.
Just one quick question. The question I asked Sherry earlier about what they thought the revenue stream might be, up about 1.5. That's not even going to be close to what you need.
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's just the ballpark. Yeah.
Any Representative questions? Olson, if I might offer one more thing.
Absolutely.
There's a type of injury we haven't talked about today that is one of the leading causes of brain injury, and that's falls among the elderly, particularly when they become frail and 85 years old. And many of them, that means early entry into long-term care. One of the things that I was doing yesterday was kicking off a Tai Chi program to improve balance and gait among seniors, and seniors are really latching on to that program, really like it. So there's a TBI affects a broad range of individuals and communities. Also, injuries due to firearms are a leading cause of brain injury. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you.
I was surprised in your written testimony, you said that it was firearms, motor vehicle, and falls. And personally, I've observed so much more violence and kids beating up on each other, and I was kind of surprised that that isn't part of the stats. I just, I've been kind of, and I'm one of those people that just doesn't like to see that, and I think I see more and more of it.
Vice Chair?
I guess it's not a question, it's probably an observation, but I am surprised it's not. It's not surfacing in our stats.
Yeah. Vice Chair Olson, Representative Van Orman. You're right. We have no data source to track that. The only data available to us are hospitalization data, and it's a very limited set of data.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons we need a registry. Another real common source of traumatic brain injuries is in battering in intimate partner violence relationships that experience that. And also, as you mentioned, in the street, a lot of intentional assault.
Okay, any other questions? Yeah. Representative
Ferguson. Vice Chair, thank you. I would, has anyone done any studies regarding martial arts? You mentioned Tai Chi. That happens to be something that I taught for a while and was involved with a number of martial arts efforts. There is a unfortunate situation that takes place within that system that you, I would anticipate you might find more injuries than people would want to admit in this. I would encourage you to take a look at that.
Thank you.
Okay. David.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is David Cracky. I am a private practice attorney in Portland. I'm also a member, a board member of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, here to give testimony in support of House Bill 3692. I haven't had the opportunity to see many traumatic brain injury clients over the years, and it's a very sad situation. Typically, it's where an injury occurs immediately, in a blink of an eye, as it were, and a person goes from normal to having this severe disability. Family doesn't understand what's happened. Certainly, the survivor doesn't understand what's happened. It's an opportunity for me to meet these wonderful people, to get a sense of what they've suffered through, and to use my interaction with them as a chance to educate them on services that are available to them, whether it be through medical services available or other community programs, especially through the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. The vast majority of the brain injuries that I have seen in my practice have resulted from motor vehicle collisions, and I think this speaks directly to Vice Chair Olson's questions with regard to the percentages and the funding mechanism relied upon or asked for in this bill. I asked my the senior partner at my firm to give an idea about ballpark how many brain injuries do we see resulting from motor vehicle collisions, and he kind of immediately said, well, pretty much all of them. And so it really is a serious thing. We do see some falls. Certainly, we see some other incidences, some anoxic situations, but primarily it's with the auto collisions. I want to present the idea that when a traffic violation occurs but does not result in an automobile collision, that that's just good luck. These are situations where the potential is always there for the traffic violation to turn into this tragedy. We've seen it. A guy runs a red light. If no one's around, it's a violation. If a police officer sees him, he gets a ticket. If there happens to be an innocent victim in that intersection, it can turn tragic immediately, and we've seen that far too often. The bill provides incremental funding, and I think the word incremental is important. Just because of that idea that so many of these violations, traffic violations, do not result in injury. But that's just, as I say, a matter of luck. The development of the comprehensive statewide plan to address the needs of the individuals with traumatic brain injuries is, I think, an excellent idea, excellent proposal in this bill, designed to maximize provider capacity, provider training, coordination of services, extremely important. Development of services for TBI survivors. What this really points out in my mind is that this bill is a way to maximize efficiency and maximize effectiveness of those resources. The penalty provisions also may actually act to educate those drivers who are cited with these violations, make them think for a second. Maybe if they question, you know, why is there this added $5 or whatever the judge decides, maybe they'll think, you know what, he's right. Tragedy was narrowly averted in my situation. And I really see that this is a minimal individual fine for maximum incremental benefit. For those reasons, for others, I encourage your support for this important bill. It's an education bill for education, for referral, and for treatment of those people who have suffered traumatic brain injuries. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Lisa, David, thank you very much. That closes the public hearing on House Bill 3692, and Vice Chair Boone.
Mr. Other Vice Chair, I would like to move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Frederick to vote on House Bill 3623.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Thank you. Seeing that, okay. So we need to open up a work session on that. Okay. Open up a work session then on House Bill 3623. And Representative Frederick, how do you vote?
I vote yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Close the work session on 3623. And
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Other Vice Chair, I would like to move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Frederick and Representative Huffman to vote on House Bill 3631.
Is there any objections? Seeing none. Open a work session on House Bill 3631. And Representative Frederick, how do you vote on that?
Vote yes on that as well.
Okay. And Representative Huffman, how do you vote?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, thank you.
There's something else we need to do.
We'll close the work session then on House Bill 3631 and stand fast.
Will you announce that these three bills are carried over till Monday?
Okay. As an announcement, the following bills are going to be carried over till Monday, and that's House Bill 3669, House Bill 3618, and House Bill 3692. Okay. Okay. Services is adjourned.
That's how it starts, Debbie.
Rick just
sorry.
Gave me
you're a cheerful one.
I can't help
sorry.
It.
Frederick is
I'm trying to be.
I know, and I mean, I don't
Debbie,
know what we're
Debbie, you are doomed.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Apparently you missed another bill.
Did?
Oh, yes.
Is that right?
3668, you've adjourned. We can't redo it. I'm not sure if we can allow you to vote.
It's over.
I think it's over.
It's over.
Yeah,